You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up on today's show, Germany's parliament has paved the way for the country's armed forces to join operations against Islamic State militants. We'll discuss that with Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Michael Binion from The Times of London. Plus, the continuing debates over migration and security across Europe. Later on, we'll head to Japan as the country steps up its counter-terror operations. And as we learn more about the people behind the latest mass shooting in the United States, we'll ask why these killings never seem to change America's attitude to guns. All to come on Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. So welcome to the programme. As I say, my guests today in the studio, Raffaello Pantucci, who's Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Michael Binion, who's a foreign affairs specialist for The Times of London. Welcome, gentlemen, both of you, and thank you for joining us. Let's start with the latest moves in the growing coalition against Islamic State fighters in Syria. On Thursday, British jets carried out their first airstrikes on IS targets in the country, just a few hours after the country's parliament had authorised the military operation. Now, Germany's parliament has voted to lend its military support. There was overwhelming support from members of the Bundestag for the move, which will see reconnaissance jets, a naval frigate, and well over 1,000 German soldiers sent to the region. Michael Binion, if I can start with you, there is an important distinction to be made between what Germany and Britain are doing here. Britain has voted for an offensive military operation against IS. Germany, very specifically, is a non-combat support role, but it's still significant, isn't it?
Oh, yes, certainly. It would have been rather surprising if Germany had actually voted for airstrikes, because that's not been Germany's policy. They have always played a, as it were, non-combative role in operations, but it's already a further step along the sort of normalization of attitudes to military intervention by Germany, which has been a slow evolution from a totally pacifist outlook, which was completely understandable after the Second World War, towards a sort of more normal participation in NATO operations. And Germany will send reconnaissance aircraft, 6 aircraft, I think, which will in themselves be extremely important and valuable and a great contribution to the Allied effort.
It's also, Raffaello, as we were saying, it is a sign that Germany is more willing to be more muscular in these issues than it has been in the past.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, it's exactly as Michael's saying. There's been this sort of gradual shift from this very pacifist country to one that's got a much more sort of robust and proactive approach to foreign policy. What's interesting now is you think about where Germany came from and you look at it today, where it's sending air crews in to fight in the sort of the most complicated conflict of our time, while at the same time, they're actually ramping up their efforts in Afghanistan as well in response to sort of growing problem there. So you see them getting involved very much on a ground and in the air. And this is a huge change from the sort of Germany that we saw in the 90s and even the early 2000s.
Some questions over the way this issue was debated in the Bundestag. One commentary, a piece that I read a little earlier, comparing a reasonably short debate in the Bundestag to that day-long, 10.5-hour debate in the British Parliament. Description in this one piece of a parliamentary declaration of bankruptcy, a sense that the members of the Bundestag were almost being bounced into this without necessarily giving it the forensic examination that the British Parliament had done. Michael, do you think that's fair?
Well, to a degree it's fair, yes. I mean, they don't really want to get into this to the point where you start opening up differences between the members of the coalition government, between the Social Democrats and the CDU, the Christian Democrats, which could open up if you had gone down the whole kind of ideology of participation in overseas operations. I think to some extent also the Germans felt, well, we have heard all the debates in other parliaments. I mean, they followed the big, long debate in the British Parliament quite closely, which I think has been quite influential. People have listened to what was said on both sides there, and I think people have understood the arguments. Those have been going on in Germany, as everywhere, about whether military operations in the end will help bring about a peace conference, which everyone knows is the only final realistic solution to this problem. I think the Germans didn't feel that they needed to repeat all that all over again.
Raffaele, one of the questions that came up during the British parliamentary debate was the lack of planning for post-conflict, for after we've apparently prevailed against Islamic State and we're left with what remains of the Syrian civil war. Was there a sufficient plan in place for that? One of the criticisms of the debate in Germany today was that there was just absolutely no mention of that. It was, as Michael was saying, there was a sense that we've heard this debated in other chambers and our decision is simply whether or not we join in a supportive role.
Well, I don't know. I must say I found the whole debate here in the United Kingdom. I mean, well, clearly there's some very eloquent speeches and some, you know, thinking and some very interesting ideas were ventilated. It seemed a bit silly in some ways. I mean, the debate here was this epic debate to basically deploy a few planes into a conflict that we're already involved in. You know, the UK is already bombing on the other side of the board in Iraq. It's already done drone strikes in Syria. They're already actively sort of involved. And so the question for me was, I don't know that that whole debate was really quite the right thing in the right forum to be sort of having this kind of a conversation about. It strikes me that, you know, did the Germans move into something quickly? Well, you know, clearly there was some sort of consensus and a debate that we should move this on. In some ways, I think that seems to be a more genuine reflection. What bothers me about the whole conversation about what we see about looking at what is going on with Islamic State is we're not actually seeing any decisive choices being made. I mean, this planning for the post-conflict thing, yes, that's true, but that's a really long way in the future. You've got not only to get rid of Daesh, ISIL, whatever you want to call them, you've also got to resolve the civil war in Syria. And all of that is just a very long-term process. And so frankly, it's not even as though I worry about people not having planned for the day after we defeat Daesh, because I think that's still quite a few years off. You know, I worry more about the fact that I don't see really decisive foreign policy decisions being made here. I see incremental changes that in themselves are actually not really significant to the sort of debates that were given it in the British Parliament.
One of the issues that seems to come up in Britain and Germany is that the politicians want to go in a certain direction and they are hamstrung to a certain extent by a very split public opinion that they're worried about the impact politically of a long, drawn-out conflict. David Cameron, the day after the vote, was saying this is going to be a very long process, rather than the day before the vote,
right.
Interestingly.
Right. Well, he'd already said it before the vote, to be honest.
Politically, how do you handle that? If you are David Cameron, Angela Merkel, and the first setbacks, the first plane to be shot down, the first time that it becomes obvious to voters that this is going to take a long time and going to be very difficult. How do you deal with public opinion on that?
Well, you treat the public like a mature adult and explain to them the issues. Now, yes, they're very complicated, but it's a complicated world that we live in. And the problem is that there's often a rush to sort of distill it down to a very dichotomous argument of evil versus good or I don't know what. And that's just not how things actually function. And if you're operating on the sort of false premise that is how things function, then you're going to continually be disappointing your publics and getting into a situation where you're sort of held up, you're shown to be sort of dragging the country into a foreign policy decision that doesn't necessarily seem to have an end. The reality is that if you're dealing with a conflict like the one that we're seeing in Syria and Iraq, and it really is in both countries, you're dealing with one which is about some fundamental issues in these countries that are going to take a long time to resolve and are not going to be resolved in any sort of a short term. And in many ways, I think that in fact it would behoove us to have a more serious sort of public conversation about that. And frankly, government should be at the forefront of doing that.
Michael, do you think governments can have those sorts of conversations with voters?
I think they can. And I rather disagree on the importance of the debate in Parliament. Mm-hmm. I think it was quite important because it was a sort of venting of the issues that have been lying there ever since the Iraq War. The shadow of the Iraq War is very much hanging over this whole debate because there is the recognition, I think, really across the country that we rushed into war really on false premises last time and that this actually turned out to be something of a fiasco. And certainly the handling of the aftermath was a complete fiasco. And so I think what we're seeing is a very high level of doubt in the public opinion polls over whether or not we should intervene in Syria is a reflection of that. And Parliament was attempting to address that legacy as well as look at the actual issues. Now, as Raffaele says, it's pretty academic whether you bomb this side of the border or that side of the border. It really is simply extending an existing military operation. But I think to have this debate and have have people vent the issues, and particularly for those on the left to deal with what they felt was a fairly toxic Blair legacy of Iraq. I think that was important, and I think they did it quite successfully. It did lead to the Labour Party being split, but those on either side were quite, articulate in voicing their deeply held convictions.
To return to the decision that was made in the Bundestag, just to close off this conversation, When Germany makes this decision, what is the most significant thing? Is it the fact that they have the military contribution that they are able to make to this operation? Or is it standing with France, showing solidarity after the attacks in Paris?
Oh, standing with France, undoubtedly. I mean, they're not going to send an enormous number of aircraft, of surveillance aircraft. They're sending some naval support and things of this kind. It really, when you compare this to the operations that the United States are conducting, it really won't make much of a difference on the ground. It's the symbol of solidarity. It's the fact that Germany is not standing aside. It's recognizing that as a member of NATO, it must stand with its allies, and particularly it must stand with France, with whom it has a treaty relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, while the EU's biggest power was debating its role in the fight against Islamic State, other issues are still demanding attention across Europe. Greece has asked for EU help to secure its borders. Now, this followed claims that it could be excluded from the passport-free Schengen zone if it didn't take action. Raffaele, after the Paris attacks, one of the things that you heard said a lot was Schengen works only if all of the countries have efficient border security. It's only under Schengen, you are only as strong as the weakest link in any of the countries within it. Well, 600,000 people have passed through as refugees into Greece since the start of the year. So it's perhaps a little late to be now thinking that you should strengthen the borders.
Well, I think that this is, clearly an incident like what we saw happen in Paris is going to galvanize people to deal with a problem which has been an issue for a very long time, you know. And it's not only about sort of protecting borders and having sort of efficient border controls and guards. It's about having internal security forces and a sort of legislative system which is sort of peered amongst each other. So if you look at the French and arguably in some ways the Germans have very sort of competent and efficient forces, but you look at some other countries around them where there is a much bigger question. And often this is down to sort of national quirks like, you know, having stronger regions versus a sort of central government. So, you know, in some places you have a very strong federal security system, whereas in others you have a very strong state one, and then different states have different sort of priorities. But yes, you're always going to be as weak as the weakest of the bunch, be that in borders, be that in internal security, be that in terms of gun legislation, you know, and the sort of ease of availability of guns in one place versus another, and then the fact that you have open borders between everyone means it's very easy for this stuff to transfer. So that is a sort of perennial issue within Europe, and it's been an issue for some time. And it doesn't surprise me that it takes an event on the scale of Paris to sort of galvanize it. I would say that galvanize sort of the response to it. But I would say that the other side of this is the Paris thing happens at the same time as we have had this refugee crisis across the continent, which has opened all sorts of questions about free movement. And I really wonder if next year we're going to be having a conversation about sort of seeing an end or a temporary end of Schengen.
Michael, Schengen's been so totemic to people who are active supporters of the European project. This idea that you can start at the southern tip of Greece, you can go all the way up and to the top of the Nordic countries and never have to produce your passport. Can it actually withstand the security concerns after Paris, the humanitarian concerns after the refugee crisis, and also the desire of Britain to already renegotiate these freedom of movement rules next year anyway?
Well, frankly, I don't think it can, no. And actually, I don't think it should. I think there are enormous benefits. Of course, freedom of travel. It's all very well for us in Britain sitting on an island to say, well, it doesn't matter so much, people don't travel backwards and forwards that much. But actually, of course, between Belgium and the Netherlands, for example, they travel backwards and forwards every single day just to go to the shops. So there it does matter, and in other countries as well. But I think for many of the countries, the overriding feeling now is they want to have control of their borders. First of all, for national security, they feel it should be up to their their own governments to ensure their safety as citizens. And secondly, they are worried about this refugee crisis, which is setting up a whole lot of competitive nationalisms, one against the other. Now, many of them have temporarily reimposed border controls. Germany has, after the refugee influx in the summer, I mean, there were controls set up with Austria. France has imposed temporary border controls. They're allowed to under the Schengen Agreement because that's part of the deal if there's an emergency. But I think quite a few people are quite happy to see those controls. And once they're there, I don't think there's any great rush to remove them again.
Well, on the subject of controls, the government in Switzerland has set out how it plans to cut the number of newcomers who will be admitted from the EU. It wants a safeguard clause, which will be triggered if immigration reaches a set limit. Now, last year, the net influx into Switzerland from the rest of the EU was 60,000 people. Michael, this is the government enacting a referendum that was held in Switzerland last year. Now, this preceded the refugee crisis, and the EU has been saying before that it wouldn't renegotiate on this issue. The Swiss are quite clearly willing to harm relations with the EU, if necessary, to get their way.
They are indeed. Well, the Swiss have this system of regular referendums on all major questions, including the most sensitive, such as freedom of movement. The Swiss, in some ways, are in an almost ideal position for themselves. They don't particularly need the EU. They're a very rich, self-contained country. Of course, it's much easier for them if they're able to be part of that border-free zone, and mostly they do qualify in almost all countries as part of the Schengen Agreement in practice, if not necessarily in jurisdiction. But because of that, they've enjoyed the benefits. But equally, they don't have to observe all these things. They can simply step back and say, well, we're not part of the new European Union, so we can change our minds if we wish. And clearly, the population has changed its mind. And the government's primary responsibility under their system of referendums is to listen to what public opinion says.
Raffaello, it is a difficult time, isn't it, to be an advocate of open borders?
I mean, it is. It is a very difficult time. And I think that, as I said before, the Paris attack and the sort of refugee crisis this year has just made it all the more harder. The question I would ask, and I haven't seen sort of efficient studies about this, is what is the economic impact of doing this? Because you saw this discussion start to happen after the attempted attack on a train earlier in the year, where this gunman on a Thalys train going from, I think it was Holland to France, was going to try to kill passengers in an AK-47 and he was tackled by a group of American Marines who happened to be on the train. There was a question then about, well, does this mean we need to secure our train systems more? And we need to start talking about putting airport-style security around the train system. And I saw some people start to look at some studies of this. And the question was not only the Schengen, what happens if we start closing our borders, what is the economic impact of that? But then there's also the question which says, well, what is the cost of putting airport-style security at every train station? And where is it that you draw that perimeter of security? And there's this whole question of the actual cost of that outweighing potentially the potential danger that you're seeing. And so I wonder if we've had a sort of proper debate and discussion about the economic loss that we might suffer if you start to see all these borders going up again across the continent. Clearly, Schengen and sort of free movement and open borders has been a huge boon to Europe, not only in terms of the sort of identity side of it, but also economically. And I don't know that I've seen a sort of convincing case made about whether actually closing the borders in response to these particular issues, the sort of economic and negatives don't outweigh the benefits.
Michael.
I was just going to say, it depends on the numbers. I agree, trains being monitored and having airport security, international trains crossing the border, that might be possible because there are not that many that cross with that volume of traffic. If it's something like an underground system, the London Underground, for example, which carries 3 billion people a year or 3 billion journeys, and they were thinking of having airport-type security just to get into the London Underground after the bomb attacks in Britain, clearly completely impossible to enforce.
But it works within the UK because you have sort of one international terminal. If you start to look at the continent and you start to look at the train networks and, you know, Thalys is not just isolated in the train stations it goes
to
being only one. That covers a whole bunch. And so you map that out across the Union, you're looking at something which could be very difficult to conceive.
Well, we will pause there for just one moment. There's lots still to discuss here on Midori House. In a moment, we'll turn our attention to Japan and talk about the United States' continuing problem with guns. Do stay with us.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. packed with opinion and reports from around the globe. It's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Paul Osborne, here on Monocle 24. Still with me in the studio, Michael Binion from The Times of London and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI. And now we started with Germany's enhanced role in the operation against Islamist militants. In Japan, the government is speeding up the launch of a new anti-terror intelligence unit. It aims to collect intelligence from those areas deemed susceptible to terrorist activity, including Southeast Asia, the Middle East and Northwestern Africa. IS kidnapped and killed two Japanese citizens earlier this year. And it's feared that as Japan seeks an enhanced international role, it could make it a bigger target for attacks. Raffaella, Japan does have some big international events coming up. It's hosting the G7 next year. 4 years from now, it's got the Olympics in Tokyo. So you can understand why they would want to step up their anti-terror intelligence. The question, perhaps, is why they haven't done it already.
Well, I mean, this is one of these historical things, right? It's a leftover from the war, and the Japanese constitution being one that meant that you had a force. Like, their army is still called the Japanese Self-Defense Forces. They're not sort of a formal army, and all their ships are ones that are sort of purchased under the auspices of being, you know, coast guards or something, rather than a sort of deployable, aggressive force. And that filtered into the intelligence space. And the intelligence space, the idea of having a sort of external intelligence service, was all linked into this sort of history of being Japan being an aggressive imperialist culture in the region. What's interesting is in the past few years, you've increasingly seen that they are, one, trying to confront this. And, you know, the Abe administration has done quite a bit about trying to reform the Japanese constitution and putting it onto sort of a different footing. But then there's this other side of the question, which is sort of raised in particular around this sort of counterterrorism unit, which is that, you know, Japanese companies are out in a lot of awfully dangerous places. If you think back to the, there was the two individuals you mentioned in Syria, but even before that, the In Amenas attack in Algeria in early 2013, where a sort of group that actually recently attacked that Bamako hotel took over the gas plant. Well, one of the biggest nationalities to suffer losses there were the Japanese. And actually, that was like one of their biggest terrorist incidents that they ever suffered from. And after that, there was a surge in sort of Japanese attempts to understand how they could protect some of these companies that they have running around. And so in some ways, this kind of fits into that that broader thing. But as I say, there is this bigger thing hanging over Japan, moving from being, in many ways, it's the discussion we're having about Germany.
I was going to say, we were talking about Germany. Yeah. And that Germany is now moving in its international operations away from the restrictions that were imposed after the Second World War. And Japan similarly famously had this pacifist constitution. As you seek, Michael, to have a bigger impact, to have a louder voice on the international stage, one consequence of that is you get noticed more and perhaps you become more likely to become a target.
Of course you do, yes. You have more people overseas. You have more tourists visiting sensitive areas. Another incident, as I think happened, was that it was mostly Japanese who were killed when gunmen attacked a group of tourists in Luxor in Egypt and killed about 20, 25 or so of them. They were nearly all Japanese tourists, and they are targets overseas, as are the businessmen, as Raphael has said. And I think that the Japanese interest is, first of all, obviously, to protect their own citizens, but secondly, to show that they are equally able to take responsibility for trying to stop the kind of wave of tourism, of terrorism, that is afflicting the world in so many different fields.
And one of the things that Japan has been doing has been trying to improve military relations with the US. We were hearing earlier this week about the governor of Okinawa going to court to try and stop the central government taking over some land for a US base and saying that to do otherwise would harm relations with America. Raffaella, when you are setting up an anti-terror intelligence gathering operation, you need support from other countries. So presumably you will be on the phone to the authorities in America asking what help they can give you.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly. And I know that historically the Japanese have relied on Americans' agencies and support to do some of these things abroad, though they have to tread a very careful line. I think there's another side to this question, though, which does distinguish it a bit from the discussion we're having about Germany before, which is that if we look at the sort of German model and you think about German history within the European Union for the past 50 years or 60 years, you know, it's one that's been very much of a Germany that's gradually gone into this phase, having been seen to publicly apologize for its role. The difficulty with Japan is there's still that great awkwardness with the other Asian powers. And so while we can see this particular sort of activity being one that's very much focused around a counterterrorism problem, it is creating an external Japanese intelligence agency, one that's being sort of openly talked about and admitted to. And that will have repercussions across the water in places like China and in countries like Korea, who've historically been very skeptical and still are a bit concerned about sort of a return to an imperial in a large Japan with a sort of aggressive outward-facing security force. And I think that's going to be a very interesting sort of conversation that we've already seen happening around the sort of debates in the constitution in Japan about putting the army on a sort of different footing. But I think this sort of increased intelligence presence will also start to really get those questions raising in Beijing in particular.
Well, finally today, officials in the United States have said in the last few hours that the woman who carried out the gun attack that killed 14 people in California earlier this week had pledged allegiance to Islamic State. Tashrin Malik and her husband died in a shootout with police after the killings in San Bernardino. Michael, officials are saying that while she may have pledged allegiance, this was not an attack, they don't believe, ordered by IS. They think the couple were sort of self-radicalized and chose to act on their own. It's still quite a frightening discovery, though.
It is. I mean, the lone wolf is always the one that one has to worry about most, because you never know where somebody will begin, where, out of the blue, somebody is either self-radicalized or has watched stuff on the internet and has become convinced that they need to do something themselves without any plot that could be discovered or overheard by intelligence agencies. Mm. And it's a double worry for Americans because, first of all, up till now, their Muslim community has been remarkably well integrated. American Muslims are generally in a slightly better position, their higher socioeconomic bracket, than Muslims, say, in Britain or France. They have been quite successful at integrating into America. There have been relatively few instances of extremist preachers in the Muslim community in America. Now, if all of a sudden Muslims now living in America are being encouraged or to be radicalized or are being self-radicalized, that's the first problem. And the second thing is this perennial problem of those with access to guns, you never know where they're going to get them and what they're going to do with them. Yeah. And this comes up again and again. And if you would combine the two things, or some people who suddenly have a message to go and kill people because this is what Islamic State wants, and the guns are available, well, it's a recipe for permanent trouble.
Rafaela, this is one of those situations sometimes where you feel like it is the rest of the world on one side and America on the other. We looked at some statistics before we came into the studio. This is UN data from 3 years ago. 30 in every million Americans statistically are likely to be murdered with a firearm. In Germany, it's 2 in a million. In Australia, it's 1 in a million. And yet these statistics never seem to alter the tone of the debate about gun control in America.
I mean, it's shocking, and it's one that's very difficult to understand. And, you know, I've got an American mother, so I feel like I have a link there and I can try to understand it. But this is one thing I just don't kind of get, this sort of inability to see that, you know, this continual diet of horrible gun atrocities, be they linked to potentially some sort of a radicalized individual, or like the guy we saw the other day who showed up at the Planned Parenthood place, you know, some person who is slightly deranged and taken on this ideology, or these horrible school shootings. It's just, there's a sort of depressing regularity to this that makes you fail to understand how they can't have a mature enough political conversation that says we need to deal with this problem and we need to legislate in some sort of way. What's interesting was the president's comments, I thought, around this, where he, you know, he seems genuinely quite despairing about
this. There's a kind of world weariness, isn't
there, really,
now,
is
to the way
it's
that Obama
sad, yeah.
does this, that he, every time this happens, he has to make a statement, and he's almost like a sort of despairing school
yes.
teacher now, where he's kind of given up trying to have this conversation. We are very, very short on time, but very briefly, Michael, all presidents in their final year get some big, big thing that they want to do. Quite often it's bring peace to the Middle East. Does Obama try to make gun control his thing, or is it just impossible?
I think he's not going to try further than he has already. It is almost impossible. And even if he gets some legislation through, it probably won't stick. Or you may have the Republicans, outvote it in Congress. And he's not going to try something that he can't really get through. He's not going to undertake something in 1 year that he can't get done and dusted by the end of his term in office.
I'm afraid we will have to leave it there. Rafaela Pantucci, who's Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Michael Binion from The Times of London. Thank you both very much. very much for joining us. And that does bring us to the end of today's Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Antonio Metzhauser, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. And Daniel will be here in just a moment to keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Half an hour from now, at 1900, it's your first chance to hear the latest edition of The Menu, and Emma Nelson will be here for the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns Monday at 1800 London time. But for now, from me, Paul Osborne, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye and have a good weekend.